Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 317. My name is Camden Busey. I'm the pastor of Hope Orthodox Presbyterian Church in Grays Lake, Illinois. I've got two regulars with me today. We've got a fun episode lined up. We'll get to that in a minute. Let me introduce to you my friends. We have first Jeff Waddington, who is stated supply at Knox OPC in Lansdowne, Pennsylvania. Welcome back, Jeff. It's good to have you.
Yes, it's great to be here, Camden.
We also have, as we would expect, Jim Cassidy, who's the pastor of Calvary OPC in Ringo's, New Jersey. Welcome back, Jim. It's good to have you on again.
It's good to be here, as always, Camden.
I guess we're the 2008 crew. The reason I bring that up is because we started Reformed Forum, actually before it was called Reformed Forum. We had Christ the Center, our first program, which came out January 25th, 2008. As we record, we're 2 days shy of our 6th anniversary, although we did record that episode in advance. I don't know what day we recorded it, but it came out Friday, January 25th, 2008. So we're almost here, precisely at our 6th anniversary, with the same crowd in which we started. So I wanted to bring that up. I had not announced that or told the Jim or Jeff before we started, so just thought I'd throw that out there and see what you guys thought of it.
All I have to say is, wow, that's pretty cool. There's 6 years almost to the date. Yeah, let's have an anniversary party. Yeah, and I remember those days very well of us sitting around the microphone, as it were, although at separated from one another geographically. We still had those opportunities together by way of technology that we have, and just sat around, chatted, talked theology, and had a great time doing it.
Yeah, there was a bit different. A lot's the same, and a lot has changed. We started the first episode, I think, we did on Skype, like we do most of our episodes still. So that hasn't changed much. You know, through the years, we've been able to get together in person and record. We all lived a lot closer to each other then. I moved away.
Yep.
But nevertheless, right. with technology, we were able to do some good things. So those episodes are still all online. I'm looking at reformedforum.org/podcasts/CTC1 right now. I'm not so excited that they're all online, because some of those are really rough episodes, but
they are humbling testimonies to our frailty and our it was at one time called, I believe, that was when it was, the website was actually called Castle Church, right?
It's because I had that domain, and it was, we're taking after, you know, of course, der Schloss Kirche, or die Schloss Kirche, my German's slipping, the Castle Church in Wittenberg, where Luther nailed his 95 Theses to the door. But what happened over time, we realized it was confusing because it sounded like we were actually a church. And so we changed names and incorporated as a corporation, a nonprofit corporation, as Reformed Forum. Probably in 2010, April 1st, 2010, so that was on, it was on April Fool's Day, I remember that, was when we filed and got our, you know, status as a charitable organization with the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, and then it took some time after that with the IRS to get official status as a 501c3 organization that with a tax exemption. So it's probably more information than people want to know, but that's a bit of our history. Christ the Center, theoretically, well, actually historically, has been around longer than Reformed Forum, even though it's the same organization. We just changed names.
I was just curious as to why we didn't change from Castle Church to Wittenberg Door.
I don't know. Again, it's like, well, we had a domain and we threw something up there, and then when we wanted to name ourselves, we had to see what domains were available, and Reformed Forum was one of our options, and it was available, and we had it.
We would have been forever tied to Luther rather than Calvin, too, so we got to keep that through.
Yeah, that might have been an issue. We've been able to do a lot of fun episodes. That first episode was the New Testament's use of the Old Testament, and it was so long, we split it into two episodes, 72 minutes for the first part. So we've been able to do that, and also building a Reformed library, those sorts of things were some of the earlier topics. It wasn't until the summertime of 2008 that we started having guests on. And at that point, I think things started to take off in terms of listenership, because no one wanted to hear us. They want to hear That's exactly right.
Nothing has changed. That's one of those things that hasn't changed. Nobody really wants to hear us.
And so there, I've already turned this episode off because we don't have a guest. Anyway, none of this would be possible, first, without God's grace, but also by the means that he uses, which is the generous support of all of our listeners. I do want to take the opportunity to thank people, and I'm still working on rounding up and sending out the donation reports for 2013. I'll have those out shortly. And we want to thank everybody for their support of helping this program to continue. And I do encourage everybody to visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate, where you can pledge your support. We do rely on the generous support from $5, $10, $15 a month or one-time gifts. It goes a long, long way. And if we didn't have the support of everyone, we would not be able to cover our costs and record these episodes and then get them out to people. So we want to thank everybody and encourage you to visit us online at reformedforum.org/donate. We thank you so much for your support of everything we do here at Reformed Forum, formerly Castle Church, and this particular program, Christ the Center. Well, gentlemen, I have an email inbox, mail@reformedforum.org, where we check our mail and we try to get back to people as much as we can. Sometimes we get questions or suggestions, things that are difficult to respond to in email. And I forward those to the contributors and see if somebody bites and if somebody's willing to write a response. But to be honest, we're not able to do all of them. So I've rounded up a bunch of these. I have a little label in our Gmail called Episode Ideas and another one for questions, those sorts of things. So I'm going to start pulling these out of a hat, as it were, and bringing them up because it's easier sometimes just to talk about these things. But we don't always want to devote an entire episode to them either, so I think this is a good opportunity for us to have a wild card episode on our 6th anniversary, or roughly thereof, and discuss many of these different issues. So let me pull this up, and we'll see what we can do. Here's one from on Hebrews 3. I'm going to keep the names anonymous because I don't technically have permission, I think. I don't know if people are expecting these to be read on air. So to protect
the not-so-innocent, yes.
Right. And if I'll try also to obscure or redact any identifying information here. Here's a question we've received or a comment. Hebrews 3 seems to state that all who came out of Egypt did not enter into his rest. I'm working to work out if this means none that followed Moses were saved. Yet surely some, John Calvin seems to be of this view, if not many, who did not enter into the physical promised land would have entered heaven. I'd certainly appreciate being pointed in the right direction. So this is a question here about the Israelites. There were those who died in the wilderness, and those people who did not enter the rest. Hebrews 3 seems to state that all who came out of Egypt did not enter into his rest. That's the guy's question. And he wants to know if this means that none that followed Moses were saved. Do you guys know what he's asking?
Go ahead, James.
No. I understand what he's saying. I don't have a good answer. So So I'm going to turn it over to you, Jeff, and then I'll hopefully... Okay. Dovetail from you, yeah.
Well, the question seems to be asking, what is the relationship of temporal punishment to eternal salvation?
Yes.
In other words, can someone be temporally punished and yet eternally saved or eschatologically saved? That's the question, really. I think in different language. Now that of course we know from the Exodus account, but all through the first five books of the Old Testament, that Joshua and Caleb of the original generation that departs from Egypt under the leadership of Moses makes it into the Promised Land. Right? Even Moses himself is not allowed the privilege of entering into the Promised Land. He's allowed to look from the mountaintop over into the Promised Land to see what he will not be entering. But he himself, because of his striking of the rock, does not enter the Promised Land.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So Oh, I'm sorry. Just to
No. Go ahead, please.
Make sure I have it clear in my mind. Would it be accurate to say that the question points up the important distinction that we often make relative to the Old Covenant and the way in which it was administered between, let's say, between the Ordo Salutis and the Historia Salutis, so that the question is, in terms of the Ordo Salutis, were those people by faith justified and thus those who would inherit eternal life versus the redemptive historical element in which the dynamic redemptive historically is that they do not enter into the land, which is, of course, a type of heaven. And so while they don't have the redemptive historical benefit or salvation, they would have, if they indeed had saving faith, the Ordo Salutis salvation.
Right.
Is that accurate?
The Historia Salutis, Ordo Salutis distinction, I think, is actually getting at the same point using a different language.
Yep.
My concern, well, let's think of, give an example of someone who experiences an analogous situation, and that would be Daniel later in the Old Testament. Daniel is in exile, right? And that's a punishment for the nation of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
But we know from Scripture that he himself is a godly man, a saint. So it is possible to experience temporal judgment without that necessarily implying eternal judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Right. That's so right. You can see the distinction at work there.
That's right. Yeah.
And of course, in the New Testament, so sometimes, I'm not sure that I'm overly persuaded by this argument, but some would argue that the punishment of Ananias and Sapphira in Acts chapter 5 does not necessarily imply that they are eternally punished.
Mm.
I don't share that view. I disagree with it, but it is a view that's out there within Reformed circles.
Mm-hmm.
And it does point up an important distinction so that, let's say, if the Lord often does, he temporally disciplines his children. So if I'm caught in a sin, I may in fact receive the temporal consequences of that sin. It may in fact lead me to physical death. And that, of course, is a lamentable thing. It's something that is sad, of course, but great saints have been known to commit great sins as well. So it may in fact be that somebody can be temporally disciplined and yet still eternally saved.
Right. You know, this very much relates to another subject I wanted to bring up. There's another email that we received. Let me read this, and then I want to connect it with something going on at the present. This gentleman asks, "Might, though I make a suggestion, it would be helpful if you could interview some people giving a basic outline of covenant theology and also interview some people to give opposite views on republication. This would be helpful and hopefully illuminating to the current discussion on these matters." I bring this up because I have the latest edition of the Confessional Presbyterian Journal, volume number 9 for 2013. And there's a series in here that continues the Westminster Seminary California Distinctives. And here's a response to John Fesco by Cornell Venema. Venema's down at Mid-America Reformed Seminary, just outside of Chicago there in Indiana, Dyer, Indiana. And then there's a response by John Fesco to the initial response, and this is on the republication of the covenant works in the Mosaic economy. And this is a very related conversation because it talks about typological realities and covenantal realities for the nation as a whole, but yet that nation is made up of individuals who are, in Abraham still, in various ways. So as Meredith Klein would say, and this is a contested point, but Meredith Klein would suggest, he argues for a typological overlay in which there are things going on for the nation as the Son of God, Israel as a nation, as a Son of God, that can be true for, as Jeff has mentioned, the nation being sent to exile, being punished. It's a type of hell, as it were, eternal punishment. But nevertheless, there are individuals in that nation who have a gracious relationship to the Lord. Daniel being one, who's a faithful believer. So he's experiencing typological hell at a national level. But individually, he has a regenerate heart and experiences the blessings of Christ. He has every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places in him. And we presume, based on faith, that Daniel is in glory right now. And so you can make those distinctions there covenantally that can be useful. But nevertheless, these are contested issues. What do you guys think of how this pertains to republication, for instance?
Well, I mean, the distinction between how Israel is dealt with as a nation and how an individual within the nation of Israel would be dealt with eschatologically holds whether you believe in you hold to some form of republication of the covenant of works. I myself am not completely convinced of the Kleinian construct. In fact, I'm probably becoming less so as days go by.
Mm-hmm.
But you still can grant that distinction. In other words, I would affirm that Moses is saved. In fact, that would be proved by his appearance on the Mount of Transfiguration.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That absolutely, and in the Book of Hebrews too, the Hall of
Faith. Exactly. Yeah. So the point. So we've got an illustration of that, don't we?
Even in Hebrews 3, he is faithful as a servant in God's house.
The point is, though, that proves the point that a person who didn't enter into the Promised Land, he's part of that generation that. Now, one could argue that he's held back for a different reason than the nation. But it is similar. Moses is in heaven with the Lord now, awaiting the resurrection at the end of the age, bodily resurrection.
Mm-hmm.
But yet he didn't enter into the Promised Land,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's right. We have to make a distinction between the if I can put it this way, the fate of the nation and the fate of individuals. Now, the question for me is, what is there a relationship between the two, and how would we formulate it? And that's where one answer would be the republication doctrine. In other words, there's that soteriologically, that is the Ordo Salutis, the Old Testament and New Testament saints are exactly saved in the same way, justified in the same way. But
and there's no disagreement on that one. Right. All parties would affirm, within the debate over the republication of the covenant works, Kleinians as well as those on the other side, that in terms of the Ordo Salutis, the Old Testament saints were saved and justified by faith alone. Because of grace alone, because of Christ alone, no less than in the new covenant.
But you've got something going on with regard to the treatment of Israel as a nation. They are prevented from, or at least the first generation, with the exception of Joshua and Caleb, are prevented from entering into the Promised Land because of their unbelief.
That's right.
As a nation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So the works principle seems to be at play there in some respect on a typological or temporal level,
right.
While on the eternal eschatological level, it's no less by faith alone, because of grace alone, because of Christ alone, than it is in the new covenant. So there seems to be some sort of a distinction that's going on there within the text of the Old Testament, but then more particularly back to the question, right? Hebrews 3 and other places within the New Covenant, the way in which the New Testament authors perceive that the nature of the covenant with Israel under Moses.
Well, I mean, you've got here. So, what is the relationship of the individual to the nation? There is obviously. How can the nation be judged, in this case, the generation that left Egypt to go into the Promised Land under Moses, except for two people? That generation does not make it in. There had to be something going on as a generation that prevented them from getting into the promised land. Some disobedience to God's word, revelation, that may or may not, I mean, do, is it a case where 75% of the people were sinful? I mean, it,
you, well, you they weren't observing the sacraments. That's one example. But because before they went in over across the Jordan, the Lord called them to consecrate themselves and circumcise themselves and those sorts of things. But I see what you're saying. You know, there's always going to be a mix. And even the works principle that seems to be at work, that's what's debated here with the republication discussion. It's not identical to what was going on in the garden. It can't be. I mean, because
that's right.
The very instant there would be any hint of transgression, then they would forfeit all blessings. What happens with Achan in Joshua 7? If there was a pure works principle, presumably the whole nation should be destroyed, you know, exiled at that moment, even before they fully inherited what they were going to inherit. But they don't. The Lord destroys Achan, and he prepares the people. And they continue their conquest. So there. If there is a republication, it's certainly more thematic recapitulation or something of that nature. It's
there,
not
there, a, there are differences between the covenant of works, and even if there is a works principle in the Mosaic administration, there are differences.
Yes. So
that has to be, you know, we could spend forever talking about the things that are the same and the things that are different.
Right.
And that might be worth a show on in its own right.
But or several. I mean, partly haven't talked about it already is because it's such a complicated issue that can't be treated in a single episode. Now, that doesn't mean we don't want to talk about it, but at the same time, it's there's a wide variety of views, and there are different contours and nuances, even among the regulars on Reformed Forum. So it's good that people are writing about these things, but it has become a heated topic.
And it's
popping up in various places, and it's going to be even more so with upcoming General Assembly and some other issues.
Sure. Yeah. I would just take this opportunity to say that this isn't, I think it's, this is my own opinion, that it's a very important issue, and yet it is an issue that we are seeing more heat produced than light in some quarters. And I would be zealous to see us as Reformed Christians in whatever denomination, et cetera, that the cool heads would prevail, that this is not the type of thing that we need to split the church over or anything like that, but that's better to have more light come from our discussions than heat, I think.
Yeah, I think this is one of those issues where, you know, certain ages in the church, certain issues need to be hammered out, and perhaps we're discovering here an area where there needs to be, the church needs to wrestle with these issues. Now, the relationship of the Mosaic administration to the Christian life and so forth has always been a perennial issue.
Oh, and, sure.
And we need to, and perhaps as the church, we need to double down, as it were, and look at this issue and see with the help of the Holy Spirit and the study of God's Word what conclusions we can reach, and also recognize that there may be questions we have that aren't answered, and we have to live with those limitations as well.
You know, it's difficult, especially for people that are new to Reformed theology and covenant theology, where you hear about there's dispensationalism, maybe there's progressive dispensationalism, then there's covenant theology. But there isn't a unified understanding of the covenants from the Reformed tradition. There's a variety of views and a range that all, you know, circle around the same core issues, but there are very different views about how the Mosaic administration relates to the overarching covenant of grace, for instance. You take a guy like O. Palmer Robertson in his book, Christ of the Covenants, and if you read that, you're going to read something very different than if you read Meredith Klein's works. It's right. Not to say one is more or less Reformed. Somebody might say very much that. Some people might argue that. But there are people that are within the tradition that are Reformed in name, and more than that, they're Reformed in conviction, but nevertheless hold a difference of opinion on some of these things. And that's been the case for hundreds of years.
That's right. Yeah, there's an umbrella here under which I think, brothers who have disagreements can reside. Of course, we're always careful to acknowledge and understand the limitations of that umbrella, and we want to be zealous and careful not to step outside of that umbrella. But nevertheless, there is an umbrella in and under which there can be a brotherly, confessionally faithful disagreement without kind of pushing each other out from underneath the umbrella. Debate it vigorously, but recognize that we're talking about a debate within the tradition that has occurred perennially throughout many years. So.
And it's obvious by our use of language that we're in the OPC, because other people would talk about the tent, but we, of course, in the OPC have talked about an umbrella.
That's because it's always raining where we are, apparently.
You don't like tents. Let me bring this up. I'll change the discussion ever so slightly. This isn't from an email, but I started reading this book that I've heard about for years and years, and many, many people have suggested this to me, but it wasn't until I turned my dissertation in that I dared open another book that didn't have something to do with my dissertation. Jim, are you feeling that too?
No, I'm still reading books that have to do with my dissertation, actually.
Well, I will be in a week or two when I get some feedback. But anyway, the book, The Democratization of American Christianity by Nathan O. Hatch. Not O. Hatch, yeah. Like with an apostrophe, but his middle initial is O. So if you're searching for him, search for Nathan Hatch.
He's not an Irishman. He's
not an Irishman. That's right.
But yeah, you have a wonderful cover here with a funny picture of this revival and people falling all over the place and all sorts of things. So when you mentioned tent, you reminded me of this great book, which talks about kind of the advancement of evangelicalism, especially in the 1830s and following, and how it was promoted along democratic principles. It's a great book, and I would suggest people read it because it's very insightful, especially for Americans and American Presbyterians to understand, from one perspective, how things got to where they are right now.
No, and we might want to mention that related to that book is an article on democratization and the offices in the church.
Yeah.
Greg Reynolds, that appears in the Ordained Servant Online, but also in the latest issue of the OPC's magazine, The New Horizons.
I saw that. Yeah, and they've just reformatted the magazine last month.
Nice look.
Looks
nice
great.
Look. Yeah.
And Daryl Hart has an article in that issue,
that relates too. Thank you for reminding me. That does also relate to this question of the democratization of Christianity. And, of course, if you've read Mark Noel has a book called America's God, where
it's
in some ways
superb.
He spells out in more detail. Now, Hatch's book is what, 30-some years old now?
1989, yeah.
Oh, only 89.
Yeah. I didn't realize it was even that old. So
24 years old. 25 years old. And Mark Noel's book just goes, builds on the insights of you'll often see Nathan Hatch, Mark Noel, and George
Marsden's
name mentioned in the same breath, because they do cross fertilize one another. But the idea is, and of course, if you know American history, you wouldn't be surprised. We're talking about the rise of Jacksonian democratic ideals, as over against. How would you describe it? A more Whiggish? Because this Jacksonian would be Andrew Jackson, who was president, who had a very different understanding of American democracy than, say, those who are of a more Whiggish bent, perhaps like myself.
Are you wigging out, Jeff?
I'm so sorry. No, the
you wear a wig, Jeff?
No, I don't actually. And then, thankfully, I know, because I've written on Jonathan Edwards. People think I wear a wig as well, but there's not enough powder in this world. Yeah, so I gave up on it. No, the if you know, if you're familiar with American political history, you'll know that there was this Jacksonian democratic ideal that not everybody in America shared, and some of that, I suppose, is a reflection of even the Federalist anti-Federalist debate regarding the Constitution, or what we would call populism versus the educated class, that kind of thing is going on in the broader culture, and it affects the Christian faith, so that in America, the offices of the church, minister, elder, deacon in the Presbyterian setting, they become, over time, they are looked upon as not important, because everybody has a vote, so to speak, if you will. And that's what Hatch is getting at. Have you finished reading the book, Camden?
No, I just started it.
Okay. So you're gonna see some of that you have the rise of the voluntary association. If people don't understand that, a voluntary association are when Christians get together to form an association to address some particular issue in culture. They don't do it within the context of their own denominational affiliation, but it's an organization of affinity. In other words, people are interested in a particular issue, and they come together as Christians from different denominations, and this gives rise to voluntary associations, which are basically an early form of parachurch organizations.
Mm-hmm.
And that's also in the mix if we're thinking about the democratization of American Christianity.
Yeah. And generally, precisely. With that comes a low view of office and authority in the church. Is that fair to say?
Exactly, because if it's all around you in culture, right? We've thrown off a king, therefore we're going to question authority in general. And you've seen that bumper sticker, right, on cars: "Question authority." To which I want to respond: how about I question your questioning authority? But that's a another animal,
do you question it is another question. Right.
And on and on and on. Right. There's such a thing as legitimate authority, and that's the what gets undermined in this kind of a context is that there is such a thing as a legitimate authority. It is delegated authority, and the officers in the church are not do not take upon themselves their calling. They are called by God, and there's a whole process that men go through, as we know, to be tested and tried and examined and so forth. But anyway, so the whole idea of the democratization of the Christian faith is in some ways a moving away from the worldview that we as Presbyterians embrace, and that's why you have an article in the New Horizons by Greg Reynolds on this topic, because we as conservative Bible believing Westminster confessional subscribing Presbyterians, in some ways we share many characteristics with the broader evangelical world, but in many significant ways we are very different, and that of course relates to Daryl Hart's article in the New Horizons as well. In fact, we probably have more differences than similarities in terms of the broader evangelical world, and yeah. it's not a new phenomenon. In other words, if you're listening to this episode and you're a Presbyterian and you're wrestling with this question, how do I relate to those in other Bible-believing churches? The articles in this question is something that we've lived with for going on 250, 300 years.
Hmm.
And it's one that will not be going away anytime soon.
Yeah. Well, I have another one here, Jeff, that we've got another fascinating issue, which also relates to society building and governments and all those sorts of things. Now, Jeff's already responded to this on email, but for the sake of the listeners, I'll share this email that we received on January 14th. Cursory readings basically say that the movement of Christian Reconstructionism is made of Calvinists, postmillennialists, and supporters of Van Til, for example, Greg Bahnsen. the CARM website, the C-A-R-M website, which can be prone to oversimplifications and strawman fallacies. I didn't write that. That's in an email. Basically paints the movement as wanting to bring back the Mosaic theocratic economy. My question is this. Is this the true of the movement, or is this the essence of the movement, and how does Van Til factor in? I've heard on your show some discussion between Van Til and 2K Views, so perhaps this plays a part as well. Jeff, you want to take the reins on this one, seeing that you already responded? How does Van Til relate to Christian Reconstructionism and theonomy, seeing that there have been Van Tilians that have been very forthright of their views on this sort of thing?
The theonomy or Christian Reconstruction is a movement that goes back, I think, to the late 60s, early 70s. It reaches its heyday in the early 80s. I would say about the time I came to faith in Christ, I was not a part of the Reformed community at that point. But even I, in my Wesleyan Arminian context, was familiar with the theonomic movement because it was making waves in the broader evangelical community. So I was familiar with it. There was even a book written against it by two Thomas Ice and H. Wayne House, I think, years ago. But anyways, the theonomic movement is primarily, though not necessarily, limited to the Reformed community. There are folk who have embraced theonomic views that are not Reformed. How they do that is, I'm not sure, but it arises out of a Reformed context. And the idea is that the Mosaic, the Old Testament, the Mosaic administration is to be applied everywhere in the world in our current context. Now, they recognize that with the coming of Christ, that there are ceremonial aspects that have gone by the wayside. So they will grant that point. But that's the general idea, for instance, that certain sins that are condemned in the Old Testament that lead to capital punishment, putting to death, that the capital punishment for those particular sins would be revived. So they are primarily Reformed. They are primarily, in terms of their eschatology, post-millennial. That is, the world is getting increasingly Christianized. That's the general idea. And there, at least among some, there is a connection with Cornelius Van Til. Dr. Van Til did use the expression theonomy, but not in the sense that it is used in the Christian Reconstruction movement. He uses the term theonomy in contrast to autonomy. And I think all Christians would grant that God is in control of his creation, and in that sense, there is a thing called theonomy, the law of God. Autonomy being, of course, man's attempt to separate himself from God's law or God's decree, which is, of course, not actually possible, but that never stopped sinful human beings from trying to be autonomous. So the connection, of course, someone like Greg Bonson, who was a Van Tilian and who was a very capable apologist, not only for the Reformed faith in general, but also for the theonomic viewpoint. You have someone like that who would trace his theonomic convictions back to Van Til. But Dr. Van Til himself, I believe, and guys, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I believe he repudiated any connection with the theonomic movement.
I don't know that, historically. I would imagine that was the case. I believe I've heard anecdotes to that effect, but I don't know if it's ever been in print.
At the very least, whether he repudiated it or not, there really is. It's not as if he was known to be a supporter.
Oh no,
of the movement, even if the movement, the leaders of the movement, see themselves as disciples of Van Til. Mm-hmm. In the case of Bonson, it's obviously true. He's a Van Tilian and a theonomist, but I would suggest that his understanding of his understanding of Van Til, maybe even, dare I say, that a bit defective because of Van Til's love of Gerhardus Voss.
Exactly. That's where I was going to say Bill Dennison's book is so helpful here, Paul's Two-Age Eschatology and Apologetics, because it demonstrates where Gerhardus Voss comes in to explicate a helpful understanding of Scripture, really what Paul's doing with this Two-Age Eschatology. And Van Til is thoroughly dependent upon Voss. We've been talking about this a lot in our Voss group. We've only had two episodes where we bring up Van Til all the time. And that's not because we're importing Van Til into Voss, but Van Til was so dependent upon him and was one of his most faithful students that it's really important to read Van Til, understanding that he has a good, solid biblical theology and a Vossian biblical theology at his foundation, and Voss is no friend to theonomy.
Right. I mean, his Van Til's understanding of the antithesis between belief and unbelief,
precisely,
is grounded in the antithesis between this present evil age and the age to come.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Those two ages or eons or ions are antithetical, and they are the source or the ground for the epistemological antithesis between belief and unbelief.
Right.
And I mentioned in that my answer to that email that I have in my possession a copy of a biblical theology of sorts, more on the level of an S. de Graaf, Promise and Deliverance.
Yes.
A Sunday school level biblical theology that Van Til himself wrote that was never published.
I've seen something to that effect in his archives.
It's a rather huge tome.
Hmm.
And when you read through it, it's a product of his later years. But it demonstrates, in my opinion, that his understanding of biblical theology is of the Vossian type. And we already knew that because he was a student of Gerhardus Voss at Princeton.
At Princeton. Followed him around
everywhere. And said that Voss was one of his favorite professors there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, not to mention that we see the influence of Voss in his theology. So you see, that's the element that separate, or one of the elements that would separate Dr. Van Til from the theonomic movement, mm-hmm. is that Vossian biblical theological connection.
Now, there and are many. Yet, oh, go ahead, Jim.
Thank you. And sorry, I don't want to delay us any longer than we have to on this, but this is a fascinating subject, because while Van Til would have separated himself from theonomy because of his two-age construction in his theology, understanding of eschatology, and the epistemological antithesis, yet at the same time, Van Til would not have gone in the direction of what we might call an epistemological dualism. So there's kind of a more of a radical two kingdom view is not Van Tilian either. So it's interesting to find Van Til and Voss kind of cutting that middle road between what some might categorize as two extremes.
You know, it's funny because it's Bonson who identifies very well that Van Til offers a bridge between Warfield and Kuiper.
Yes. That's
and,
right.
And you know, particularly through his doctrine of common grace. And that also needs to be negotiated here too, and how it relates to theonomy.
Yeah, one of the things that's interesting about Van Til's understanding of common grace, and this has been discussed in the scholarly literature, Van Til has a notion of common grace that is historical or eschatological. And as over against someone like Abraham Kuyper, who was one of Van Til's predecessors, whose understanding of common grace is more, how do we put it, territorial in terms of space. And so you see
– Or disciplines even.
You see the Vossian influence on Van Til even in his understanding of common grace.
Hmm.
For instance, you know, and also that common grace is the playground for special revelation, that common grace, natural revelation of the playground for, for special revelation. Common grace allows the gospel to go out, creates the context in which the gospel is proclaimed by the church, and the elect are drawn to Christ throughout history. Common grace. It can become murky when you're looking at Van Til's relationship to theonomy, because so many theonomists are Van Tilian in some respect. But in terms of eschatology and Van Til's commitment to biblical theology, they part company.
Hmm.
That's right. So I think common grace seems to be the subject field upon which the debate is going to have to focus. And if we can get common grace right, the exact nature of common grace, and as Van Til has articulated, his book, of course, Common Grace in the Gospel, I think is absolutely essential reading in this regard.
Yes.
That book has its own evolution, starting from articles and being edited and having a couple of different editions. I don't know if this is actually the case, but last I heard, I think Dr. Oliphant's working on an annotated edition of that.
I believe I've heard that too. So
I don't want to stamp that, and I don't want to let the cat out of the bag, but you can guess who the publisher might be if that's true. But
TNT Clark.
So if it's not Brill. Well, we've been talking about a lot of issues related to systematic theology, and one question I receive a lot in the mail, I should say we receive, but I'm the one checking the mailbox usually, is here. This is a fairly representative of a common question, and one we should probably do a blog post about, so I could post, you know, a link to our response. This gentleman writes, I just got plugged into your podcast and website and see and hear a lot towards your love for systematic theology. Over the last year or so, I've been reading Wayne Grudem's Systematic Theology because it was recommended to me and appears from my circle of influence to be the most popular. I was wondering what systematic theology books you would recommend. Now, I'll augment this question because I often get people asking, either they're lay people very, very much interested in learning more about Reformed theology, but they're not probably going to want a full multi-volume systematic theology. So let's start with single volume STs. What would you recommend to somebody who would like to learn more, perhaps like to study more on common grace and some of these other features, but not quite ready to invest the money and perhaps even the time for, you know, Bovink? I would say we would all want somebody to get the Bovink four volume set, or Hodge, Turretin, if they really want to get into some scholastic theology. But those big sets, maybe not going to be as useful as a starting point.
You do have the single volume abridge, condensation of the four volume Bovink.
I recommended that one, and that's a fantastic volume, one that people should take a look at getting.
The single volume that Bovink himself actually wrote as a single volume.
Mm-hmm. Our Reasonable Faith.
It would be good as well. So those two would give you the Bovinkian. Right. There's also Louis Burkhoff.
Yep.
Still valuable in terms of a single volume.
I was going to suggest three. Okay. Burkhoff. I just think so much of what some have called the big blue sleeping pill. In many ways, Burkhoff is Bovink condensed as well.
Maybe in too many ways.
in too many ways. But Burkhoff is, I think it's the best that's out there still, for a single volume systematic theology. For me, it was, indispensable to get ready for, ordination trials and et cetera. So, of course, that's not to take away at all from Bovink's Our Reasonable Faith, obviously a very valuable volume. Burkhoff's a little bit more updated, not much, but a little bit more. And he's going to give you the historical perspective on the different traditions. What I found so very helpful was, how does Reformed differ from Roman Catholic, Lutheran, Arminian, yeah, et cetera. And he splits that out very nicely in the book, so you can see how the Reform differs from the other traditions, which only helps to ingrain in our minds the significance and the importance of why we believe what we believe.
Yeah. Absolutely. And of course, any single volume, you can't just take one thinker and say, nobody's going to agree with everything in a single volume, systematic theology. There's some issues of Bavinck and Burkhoff especially that have come up recently regarding active and passive or objective and subjective justification, those types of things. And those are very much kind of developing debates and issues we've talked about with Lane Tipton and other points. Mm-hmm. And you're going to find little things like that may or may not be the most helpful. That's why it's good to read a range of things. But Burkhoff is indispensable, should be on the shelf. But again, it's not an easy read. I had to force myself. I put myself on a 3-month reading plan a long time ago because it was on the Westminster pre-seminary reading list. So I wanted to read everything that was on that list. So I had myself on a plan to get me through this book, every page of it, for over 3 months. It was tough.
It was tough. Yeah, it is a tough haul.
But I did it. And then I got to seminary, and Carl Truman said, anyone who's read that cover to cover has to be insane. And I was looking around thinking,
We're all insane. We're all insane.
Let me offer another one. I want to get your feedback on this, because we haven't talked about this volume very much, and I've only read portions of it. So I don't have a fully worked out opinion or a recommendation on this volume, but it's Concise Reformed Dogmatics by J. Van Genderen and Velema. It's published by PNR probably about 4 years ago. What do you guys think of this volume? Have you been able to read much of it?
Only portions of it. So, I've read other reviews of it that speak highly of it. But
6 years ago. Wow.
It reflects, of course, the Dutch or European context.
You get some of the more contemporary debates in here, and you get some more of the Bardian, not influence on these thinkers, I don't believe, but more concerns with neo-orthodoxy, those types of things.
Yeah.
We're not going to get that in Bavinck or in Burkhoff or Bavinck.
With this book, you're going to have much more contemporary interaction, late 20th century. You'll have interaction with Barth, which is important. But many of the other theologians that they interact with are going to be, from our perspective anyway, somewhat esoteric. Because as you mentioned, Camden, they're interacting with those on the continent. They're in Europe. Many theologians that none of us are terribly familiar with.
Yeah. Let me throw one out there. This is probably not a great suggestion for somebody just wanting to buy a single volume ST, but it's also a book that I don't believe many people are very familiar with. It's called An Introduction to Reformed Dogmatics by Auguste Le Cerf. Now, he's a French Reformed guy. We mentioned him on previous episodes once in a while, but this book here that I have was first published in 1949, and at the time, I'd never heard of this guy, but this book is just really great and very much dependent upon that Dutch style of theology, as well as the post-Reformation Reformed dogmatics. So this book covers a whole bunch of issues and from a different perspective than you're going to find in other places. I think it deals a lot with Thomism and some other issues. I'm trying to get to the contents here.
Yeah, there's
a lot of epistemological issues here. Very much Vantillian, even though he is not Vantillian, if that makes any sense. I mean, he sounds like Vantil, but he doesn't appeal to Vantil. He's a contemporary.
It's one of the things he comes highly recommended.
Yeah.
One of the things I was going to say about Burkhoff was that he is a kind of a digestion of Bavinck, but he's a Dutch American. So there are going to be some concerns with regard to Christianity in America that Burkhoff deals with that you won't find in Bavinck. Mm-hmm. So if you were looking for that unique element in Burkhoff, he's not merely just a reproduction of Bavinck. He does address issues that have arisen at the time that he was teaching at Calvin Seminary back in the 20s and 30s and 40s.
Yeah. I guess.
But also reflecting the context of the Dutch community in America and how how Dutch Reformed folk would interact with the broader Christian community in the United States.
For those interested in the Le Cerf volume, Le Cerf is spelled L-E-C-E-R-F. I'll try to put a link to that in the show notes. Or Joel will. Joel, if you're listening, Auguste Le Cerf. Well, guys, this has been a great discussion. Do we have any other books to mention or any single volume STs that we might share with our listeners? I would, of course, recommend that you visit our recommended reading list at reformedforum.org/resources/reading list. And we have that broken down by discipline and reading level. And we have a little plan there for you if you'd like to get on a reading plan that will broaden your horizons as well as build a very solid foundation. Then you'll start to specialize in various things as you continue to read through the list. So anything else we want to add to that?
Well, there are, of course, plenty of single-volume systematic theologies as well as the multi-volume. Mm-hmm. And Grudem is a good volume.
It is.
But of course, he's a Baptist and a Reformed Baptist, and so we
continuationist
would
of
continuationist
of sorts
as too. Well. Mm-hmm. So we would have that difference with him. He did make the comment. I don't know if it's in that volume or wherever it is. If he were on an island and only had his Bible, he would become a Baptist. And you know, I disagree with that wholeheartedly. Although I've never been stuck on an island by myself with only my Bible.
Well, but, at an island, you only have the ocean to get baptized in. So, I mean, you don't really, there's not enough water.
It's too much. Oh, my.
Oh, boy.
Well, if people would like to offer feedback or ask more questions, perhaps we'll do another one of these episodes in a couple months. You can email us at mail@reformedforum.org. That's probably the easiest way for us to log these questions and store them away for future use. Of course, we try to get back to people and email them a response as quickly as we can, although we're not able to do that for every single question. You can also tweet us at Reformed Forum, and we love hearing from you. We love interacting. So do that and let us know what you think. I would like to point people back to our website as the main source of information from us, where you can find our resources at reformedforum.org. There you'll find all of our programs going back all the way to episode 1 of Christ the Center, January 2008. And you can download the first 300 episodes if you'd like as one gigantic zip file. I just tweeted a link to that last night, and hopefully I could put that on the website again so people can find it. If you'd like to download 7 gigabytes of MP3s relative to all sorts of discussions in Reformed theology. We've talked about a lot of things. We expect to talk about a lot more going on into the future. But until then, we hope that you find us online, give us your feedback, and we want to thank everybody for listening, and we hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.